You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of us go through a big career change in our lives, and we want to hear from you. If you've made a big change of career or are planning to, give us a call. We'll take your calls in about 15 minutes. The number will be 800-642-1234. First, in a tweet last week, President Trump said that he hereby ordered American companies doing business in China to start looking for alternatives. The tweet comes as trade tensions with China continue and after the U.S. and China both promised to raise tariffs again. But there are questions about whether the president has the power to bar American companies from doing business in China and whether Congress would try to override it. Judith Allison Lee is an international trade lawyer with the firm Gibson Dunn based in Washington, D.C. Judith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rob.
Well, what is your read on this? Does the president have the power to order companies to start pulling business out of another country?
Well, the law that the president cited is called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. This was passed in 1977, and it gives the president extremely broad authority to respond to what is described as an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States. So if the president determines that there is this unusual and extraordinary threat, and that is officially proclaimed in an executive order, the act gives the president, as I said, extremely broad authority to take any kind of action with respect to a foreign international threat. So technically speaking, if the president were to make this declaration, and it certainly could not be done via tweet, it would have to be done by an executive order, then under the statute, he certainly would have the authority to prohibit U.S. companies from doing business with or in China. It's an extremely broad statute. It has never been used with respect to this type of situation where you basically have a trade dispute between two countries. In the past, this statute has really been used by many different administrations to target emergent international threats relating to, for example, narcotics trafficking or weapons of mass proliferation, destruction proliferation, terrorism financing, these types of threats. So this is a novel use or threat of use by the president with respect to the trade disputes with China.
What would this mean then for that American company that has, say, a factory in China or does business with a Chinese-owned factory in China?
It would be extraordinarily disruptive. Up until now, the statute really has been used, as I mentioned, to target specific threats. And the countries that it has been used against have been, Iran, Syria, Sudan, countries that don't have the type of economic integration with the United States that China does. So if the president were to follow through with this threat by issuing an executive order and prohibiting U.S. businesses from doing business with or in China, it would be extraordinarily disruptive. And, as you can tell by the reaction of the stock market over the past several days, the uncertainty that has been generated by the threat to use this statute has caused a great deal of distress within the global economic world.
Talking to Judith Allison Lee, international trade lawyer with the firm Gibson Dunn, based in Washington, D.C., talking about the president's statements on Twitter that he was ordering companies, American companies, to stop doing business in China. To get nitpicky here, Judith, if I am a Canadian company and I have some business operations in the United States and some in China, does this have any impact on me?
It could. It certainly could. If you've got a U.S. subsidiary or a U.S. parent, and in today's global environment, a lot of the supply chain is international, then the fact that U.S. companies would be prohibited from dealing with Chinese companies could certainly impact not only Canadian companies, but, companies around the world. So we've seen broad disruption and distress within the global markets because of this threat. it doesn't just affect U.S. companies. It has a much broader effect worldwide.
If this emergency power were invoked in the way the president says he would use it, and companies did in fact start removing operations from China, would those, I guess, jobs at those factories, say, necessarily come back to the United States?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. In fact, this administration's very aggressive posture toward China has already caused some companies, some U.S. companies, to consider alternative sourcing. Even before this threat to use this 1977 statute, the president's imposition of tariffs against China has caused some U.S. companies and even non-U.S. companies to consider moving operations from China, but they're not coming back to the United States. They're going to other low-cost manufacturing countries within Asia and other areas of the world.
I won't ask you to read the president's mind, but is there some thought that the threat of invoking this power might be just that, a threat to try to get an advantage with China in trade negotiations to say, hey, here's how serious we are?
Absolutely. I think that certainly is a possibility. And as a lawyer, you know, concerned with the rule of law, it's distressing to see the president or any administration use a statute that really is devoted to or focused on the national security of the United States used as a leveraging tool in a trade dispute. As I mentioned, this, you know, this trade dispute with China has been going on for many, many years, lots of different administrations. So it's a stretch to say that right now in 2019, we have an unusual and extraordinary threat that requires such drastic action.
Now, this is something that if the president were to do it, Congress could step in and try to assert their authority and say, no, that's not what we meant by emergency. There's not, I guess it's not really we. Most of them weren't there in the 1970s when it was passed. But you get the gist. Congress could step in and try to stop the president, right?
Absolutely. So Congress gave the president this extraordinary power within this statute. Congress can take that away. Absolutely. And, you know, there has been a lot of resistance within the Congress to push back against some of the president's trade posturing and negotiations. But this is so disruptive that if the president really were to consider going down this road and, for example, issuing an executive order that primes the pump for these sanctions to be imposed, I think you would see Congress taking some action.
That's Congress. How about in the courts? If my hypothetical company, Robco, was ordered to remove business from China, could I go to court and say, hold on, I'm challenging the notion that this is an emergency under the statute as passed by Congress?
Well, I'm afraid Robco would have a very difficult time persuading a judge that, you know, this the president, the administration doesn't have the authority to declare it basically a national emergency. The statute is based on the national security concerns of the United States, and judges are very reluctant to overrule a decision by any administration that's based on the national security of the United States.
You mentioned that trade uncertainties were making some companies rethink their willingness to do business in China. Are there international companies who might look at this and say, well, do I really want to be doing business in the United States given the risk of this kind of proclamation coming?
Absolutely. You know, the more the president or any administration takes actions under IEPA or other statutes that, you know, impose unilateral sanctions, it really does provide an incentive for companies to say, look, you know, there's a cost to doing business with the United States or to be setting up a subsidiary or, you know, business operations in the United States, if that means that my business is going to be subject to this uncertainty. So although the statute gives the president broad discretion to respond to international emergencies, you know, the U.S. is still part of the global economic, you know, order and is the leader in the order. And so taking these kinds of actions always has the potential unintended side effect of, you know, causing some international companies to look elsewhere.
As we wrap up, Judith, as you say, a tweet is not an executive order, even if it has the word hereby in it. What are you watching for next as we watch this possible executive order maybe coming out?
Wow, it's really been kind of a ping pong game within the past several days with the tweets coming out and the threats and the stock market dropping and, you know, the conciliation that apparently has happened within the past 24 hours. I think that the market is very sensitive to this. And if there are any indications that the administration is actually drafting an executive order, I think you will see a big effect in the stock market and global markets. So I think that's really, you know, what we'll be looking for.
Judith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
That's Judith Allison Lee, an international trade lawyer with the firm Gibson Dunn, based in Washington, D.C. She's with us today to talk about a law the president says gives him the power to restrict business with foreign countries. The president stating on Twitter that he would use that power targeting businesses in China. Coming up, career changes happen for many of us for a variety of reasons. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you made a big U-turn in your career or a 90-degree turn in your career throughout your life? How did it go? What did you learn from the experience? Are you thinking about doing it in the near future? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll take your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a disease that has destroyed banana crops in much of the world has made its way now to the Americas. We'll talk about the disease and why other crops may face similar threats. Now, Indianapolis Colts quarterback Andrew Luck announced that he'll retire from the NFL at the age of 29, in part because of the cumulative impact of injuries over the years. By leaving the NFL, Luck is going to be making a big career change. Very few of us have made the jump from professional athlete to something else, but a lot of us have switched gears at one point or another in our lives. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234 about your career change, past, present, or maybe future. Maybe you decided your job wasn't for you. Maybe your passion, you found it elsewhere. Call in with your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Before we go to your calls, let's give a listen to former NFL quarterback Andrew Luck.
I've been stuck in this process. I haven't been able to live the life I want to live. Taking the joy out of this game. And after 2016, where I played in pain and was unable to regularly practice, I made a vow to myself that I would not go down that path again. I find myself in a similar situation. And the only way forward for me is to remove myself from football in this cycle that I've been in. Come to the proverbial fork in the road. And I made a vow to myself that if I ever did again, I would choose me in a sense.
Well, have you been at that fork in the road? Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Anne with us in Green Bay. Anne, hi.
Hello. Well, I'm going to be making a major career change. I'm retiring, officially done the last day of this week.
Wow.
And I'm going to go from working to volunteering.
Do you have some volunteering lined up already, Anne?
I do. I'm going to start getting into these horse therapy places where I can work with the horses. So I love horses. I've had them when I was a kid. I missed them, so I'm going back to the horse business.
Oh, what a great way to volunteer and help other people in retirement. And this has got to be a dream come true to work with the horses and the people now.
Yep.
All right. And congratulations on the retirement. Good luck with the horse therapy. We'll go now to Jeff in Menominee Falls. Jeff, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what was your career change, Jeff?
I had been in the restaurant industry for about 20 years and then decided that I was just getting kind of burnt out with it and ended up in the construction industry.
I was hearing somebody talk about, just yesterday, somebody talk about being in the restaurant world and saying restaurants are great if you never want to have a family, but your business hours are dinner time. You know, a key part of the day and evening, you're away from your family. Was that part of the story for you, Jeff, why you wanted to switch?
Yeah, that's very true. You tend to work a lot of evenings and weekends and holidays, and Yeah, you definitely miss out on a lot of family time.
So were you glad you made the switch?
Oh, absolutely. I would never go back to it. I was definitely, I have fond memories of it, and I really enjoyed it in my 20s and that. But once I got into my 30s, it was definitely time to make a change.
Jeff, thanks so much for sharing that story. We are asking about your career change. Have you made a big switch in your life? Are you about to? Are you thinking about it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hello. Yes, I've actually had my own businesses for the last 25, 30 years, mainly dealing with entertainment, mobile DJs. I just turned 50 last week, and I'm going back to school at the university to become a teacher.
Wow, that's a pretty big change, John. What led you to do that?
Well, my kids started going to the middle school, and I volunteered for after-school programs, and it reminded me from 30 years ago when I was in college how much I enjoyed teaching.
Fantastic. And you're just kicking off the education school this fall?
Actually, I started last fall.
Oh, great.
So
okay.
This will be my second year in.
All right. Good luck with your studies and good luck with your second career as a teacher, John. Thanks so much for calling in. We'll go now to Carla with us in Madison. Carla, hi.
Hi. So this just hits home really well. My husband was in the printing and advertising industry and worked for a huge company out of Milwaukee. And with the internet, those jobs are going away. Everybody can do their own printing right from their computers and advertising and such. And it's hard to find a job now that pays what he used to make. He's making only a third of what he used to make working for the state of Wisconsin. And we've had to give up our whole lifestyle, our house and everything, just because midlife, he's 50, people aren't really giving us a fair chance at our age.
Wow, so it was a career change of necessity, it sounds like, Carla, not something that he had been hoping to do.
Correct.
All right. Well, good luck to you and your husband. Thank you so much for sharing that story, Carla. We are asking you to share your career changes, past, present, or future, after NFL quarterback Andrew Luck surprised fans everywhere with his announcement that he was retiring at age 29. Maybe your story is not that dramatic. Maybe it's more dramatic. I don't know. Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Carol on Facebook. Carol says, I was in social work for 14 years, but I couldn't save the world, and it made me very sad. I left to raise my children, which for me was the most important and best decision of my life. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jordan is with us in Marshfield. Jordan, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I love the show.
Thanks. What was your career change, Jordan?
Well, at the age of 30, I decided to go and pursue. I had a career in business and left for a few years to go and do policing, and now I am back at the same employer that I left to do it.
Wow. What made you go from the first change, business, to policing?
Well, so I had wanted to do it forever, and it was one of those things where I just started doing business after high school and out of college and stuff, and then the desire to go and do that just never went away. So I just took the leap, took a 50% pay cut, jumped in and did it. And after a few years, liked it, was good at it, but then decided for the family and stuff to go back to right where I left off, which been back for about 3 months now, so happy to be back.
Wow, Jordan, thank you so much. Wow, that's quite a story. Thanks for sharing that with us. Ken joins us next in La Crosse. Ken, hello.
Howdy.
What'd you want to tell us about, Ken?
Well, I did 20-some years as a mechanic from the time I got out of high school or even before that. And in my early 40s, I decided that small business just wasn't getting it. So I went back to school, ended up with a master's degree in counseling psychology. I worked that for a couple of years and decided that I really was not made for sitting behind a desk. So I looked around and found a job working with the state as a maintenance supervisor on a military base. Did that until I was old enough to retire. And since I retired, that's been about 15 years ago, I've been just as a sideline customizing street rods.
Wow. Okay. So, Ken, your skills as a mechanic and your skills dealing with people as a counselor sounds like a perfect match for being a maintenance supervisor, right? You got the best of both worlds there.
It worked out well for me.
All right, Ken, thanks a lot. We'll watch for your street rods out there that you're working on out in the streets. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234 if you dial fast. Tell us about your big career change or maybe a career change in the works. We'll go now to Tim with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Tim, hello.
Hi there. Yeah, I just wanted to tell you, I was a truck driver for the big brown machine, I guess. I did that for 13 years. I made a lot of money, almost six figures. Very unsatisfied with the work I did. It got kind of boring, the numbers. My body couldn't take it. Went back to school for nursing. Got an LPN and an associate's and now a bachelor's in nursing. And I never had any college experience. I went back at 35 years old.
Wow.
And I'm doing great now. I love what I do. I get to help people. And I work for the veterans. Help the people that I feel made the most sacrifice for myself, and it's just very satisfying work. So,
Tim, it sounds to me like you're not probably not making as much money, but you're finding it a lot more fulfilling.
Yes, yes. I enjoy what I do, and you know, everybody thought, well, this guy's crazy leaving us. Nobody leaves those kind of jobs, but you know, it's not about the money. It's about being happy with what you do. So.
Tim, thank you so much. That's a good story to leave it with. If you still want to share your story of a career change that you've done at some point in your life, maybe that you're going through right now, let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Share your story there. Coming up, a devastating disease that's ruined banana crops around the globe has made its way now to South America. We'll talk about that disease, the future of the banana, and other crops that may face similar risks. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on the morning show, it can be hard to cope with the loss of a beloved family pet. Keely Boltina and her guests look at the grief that comes with the death of a pet, and you could share your stories and maybe your advice for someone else going through the same thing. It's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Jenny Peek with the answer to a Why Wisconsin question about elections.
We recently received a question from listener Helen Leong. She asked, why are Wisconsin Supreme Court justices elected in a popular vote? To find out, I reached out to former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice and Marquette Law Professor Janine Geske.
Hello.
Hi, is this Janine?
It is.
Hi, this is Jenny Peek with Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Sure. No, I was happy to do it.
So we had someone write in and say they had lived in a couple of different states and they thought it was kind of funky that Wisconsin elected its Supreme Court justices in an election.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to talk to you and try to learn a little bit more about why we do it the way we do.
Supreme Court justices, as all our judges in Wisconsin, run for election. In particular, our Supreme Court justices have to have been lawyers in Wisconsin for at least 5 years. The Constitution was set up in a way that only one justice is up at a time. Part of the reason for that is to try to build stability into the court. The justices' terms are 10 years. However, if a justice either dies or retires or gets appointed to another court and leaves a vacancy, then the governor has an opportunity to make an appointment.
Do you know how long the state has done it this way?
There was a debate at our Constitutional Convention in 1846 and then in 1848 about whether we should have an elected judiciary or an appointed judiciary. As your listener had pointed out, different states do it differently. Wisconsin was very much a progressive state that was deeply debated, and it was a divided issue at the time of the Constitution. But ultimately, the founders decided that we should allow the people to elect the judges. And the debate at that time was between fearing that if people were elected, they would only decide whatever was popular as opposed to what may be legal, versus the fear that if you let people be appointed, it was going to be the politically elite who got appointed.
And so how do other states choose their Supreme Court justices?
Well, it's a great question, and many states do it in lots of different ways. Most of the original colonies actually have an appointed judiciary. A lot of them will have a commission, sometimes appointed by the governor and the legislature and the state bar. And in some states, you have to have a confirmation, like at the U.S. Supreme Court. Then a number of states have what is called the Missouri Plan. Rather than having standard elections for judges, judges would run on their own records. So what I mean by that is I was had my 10-year term, and it was time for me to stand re-election. Only my name would be on the ballot. And depending on the state, I would have to get a certain percentage of approval rating. If I did not get that vote, I would be off, and the governor would go through a process of appointing somebody else. And it's a mixture of appointment and handed just by the legislature and the governor and electing by the public. And a lot of people have seen that as sort of a compromise of the two kinds.
So is there anything else that you think people should know about this process?
The thing that we should always be looking at is whether or not people are having confidence in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Ultimately, we are best served in our three branches of government if that court is independent and we elect people who believe that, that most important is the independence of that third branch.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Jenny Peek.
Now, go into any grocery store at any time of the year in the United States, and more likely than not, you'll see bananas. Lots of them, usually as one of the less expensive fruit options. Bananas have been a popular food item for years and are the main ingredient in a lot of our favorite recipes, but the future of bananas could be in jeopardy. A disease known as Fusarium wilt, a tropical race 4, has been devastating banana crops around the globe, namely in Asia, Australia, Africa, and the Middle East, but now we're seeing the first confirmed case found in the Western Hemisphere. Our next guest is here to talk about the disease and how other crops like coffee and cocoa could face similar diseases in the future. Caitlin Allen is a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this disease affecting bananas, whose name I just butchered there.
That would be Fusarium wilt.
Thank you.
It's caused by a fungus, and it kills trees quite quickly. Two important things for listeners to know. First of all, it's not dangerous to humans directly. There's nothing poisonous about diseased bananas. And the second thing is that it's not going to drive the banana extinct. The most likely outcome is that bananas are going to be more expensive, at least in the short term, and also, unhappily, that there'll be increased levels of hunger in parts of the world where people count on bananas as a staple crop.
As I understand it, we've been here before. The kind of banana we see at the store is called the Cavendish banana. It was not always our number one selection, right?
That's true. Yeah, the reason that we are facing this problem right now is that we have genetic uniformity in banana plantations around the world. This Cavendish variety, the one that we all know and love, it travels well, it has a mild flavor, it ripens predictably, it's productive back in the field, was not our first choice for large-scale banana plantations. The first choice was a variety called Gros Michel, or Big Mike, as people called it in the English-speaking world. But it was susceptible to race 1 of Fusarium. And back in the 1950s, this spread very quickly around the world, probably through infected banana cuttings, and pretty much wiped out Gros Michel. There was billions of dollars of loss. That was in 1950s dollars, so we're talking about a lot of money. And in response, the Cavendish banana was widely planted because it's resistant to Fusarium race 1. But unfortunately, it's susceptible to this new race 4.
Now, when we see a disease like this spreading in bananas, is there a way to stop it? I mean, is there any thought that, okay, we can turn the tide and save the Cavendish banana?
Maybe one question is, do we want to save the Cavendish banana? Maybe it would be nice to have more diversity. Certainly in terms of sustainable farming practices, it's better to plant a lot of different kinds of bananas. Banana production is a small margin operation, and it's controlled by relatively few multinational companies. Here I'm talking about the dessert bananas, the sweet ones like Cavendish. And because it's a small margin, those companies tend to be highly competitive and not very open to change. But if they planted a lot of different varieties, they'd have a bulwark against the disease.
You study diseases that affect a lot of different crops. Is this a common problem if we have a monoculture? We grow the same strain of whatever kind of produce and lots of it and all over the world. Are we just putting a bullseye on it for a disease that's going to spread around the world?
That's exactly right. That's the whole problem. There's a strong reason why people do large-scale monoculture. It's profitable, it's predictable, it's easy to manage. You can sell stuff in advance, and grocers know exactly what they're going to get. But, as you say, it's the all-you-can-eat buffet for a pathogen. If one banana plant in a big plantation is susceptible, since they're genetically uniform, they're clonal, they're all susceptible to the same disease. So it makes for crops that are super vulnerable. And other examples of this that have led to gigantic, disastrous epidemics in the past include the Irish potato famine, which was caused by an oomycete pathogen that attacked potato and caused late blight. And then more recently, often associated with tropical cash crop agriculture, big problems in coffee and in cacao, rubber. There's a long list. And in most cases, companies lost money, but at the local scale, the workers had much more catastrophic personal effects. So these things can have big socioeconomic impacts beyond the bottom line for shareholders.
Now let's talk about coffee. That's been in the news over the last few years. There is another pathogen attacking our world's coffee supply?
That's right. This is a fungus that causes coffee rust disease. And coffee rust has been known since it caused a catastrophic, really disastrous epidemic in the 1860s and 70s in what was then Ceylon and is now Sri Lanka. The British, who owned the island at the time, essentially planted the whole thing to coffee. And so when the rust pathogen arrived, it spread very quickly and destroyed the coffee industry there. This led to Queen Victoria's It's Patriotic to Drink Tea campaign because tea bushes replaced the coffee plantation. But then the disease has now spread, and we generally control it by spraying fungicides or by planting resistant varieties. But the resistant coffee varieties so far don't have the ideal flavor profile, the Arabica, that people really like.
Is there a common thread these days when it comes to plants at risk, when it comes to something like climate change?
That's a really good question. Certainly, as temperatures increase and as rainfall becomes more erratic, we're seeing this happening already, and it's not going to get better as climate change progresses. Plant diseases are going to become bigger problems and also less predictable. A lot of plant disease management happens because we can say, you need to control this disease in this region at this time of year with a chemical spray or some other kind of intervention. But if we don't know what the weather is going to be like, then it's much more difficult.
We're talking to Katalin Allen right now, professor with the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. She's with us to talk about a disease that's ruining banana crops around the world, now spotted in South America, and other plant pathogens that affect a lot of the crops we depend on, coffee, cocoa, as you heard, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this disease that's affecting bananas, the one that's affecting coffee, about how all of this works and what we do about it? Do you think we as Americans need to reevaluate the foods that we import and eat? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, look at more possible solutions to these problems coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about a disease that's ruining banana crops and what other crops could face similar issues in the future and what to do about it. Caitlin Allen is with us, professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Caitlin, you mentioned one solution being, hey, maybe we need more variety, more diversity within crops like bananas. Another suggestion, another solution people are looking at is genetically modified organisms. What's out there in the research on that?
That's right, Rob. So GMOs tend to be controversial when you bring them up, but that's often because people don't fully understand the potential, the real risks and the real potential benefits. There are disease-resistant bananas, for example, Cavendish variety bananas that resist Fusarium tropical race 4. These were developed by an Australian lab, and they've been in field tests for 7 years now. I don't think they pose any human health risks. There are a number of other important plant diseases that potentially can be controlled by genetically modified organisms. It's not a process that, biologically speaking, is reasonably different from traditional crop breeding. And in the case of diseases, it reduces use of insecticides, pesticides, fungicides. So they often are much more environmentally friendly approaches. But of course, they are controversial.
What kind of technologies are we talking about for something like bananas? Is it, okay, we're going to look at a different kind of banana or a different strain of Cavendish and move the genes from here to here? Or are they using that the CRISPR gene editing technology or both? I don't know.
Yeah. So in the case of the tropical race 4 resistant Cavendish bananas that the Australians developed, they've got two genes in them. One is from a wild banana variety, so it doesn't happen to be sexually compatible with breeding bananas is complicated. I'll just leave it at that. And the other is from a little round worm that lives naturally in the soil. And the two of them together make plants essentially immune to tropical race 4.
And I think when people hear, okay, you're transferring genes from a banana to a banana, they might not worry about that. When you're saying a gene from, say, a roundworm to a banana, people may feel less comfortable with that.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where the concept is scarier than the reality. The reality turns out to be a gene that causes the plant cell to die as soon as it recognizes the presence of the fungus. And so it's like a little micro walling off. The fungus can't progress any further because the cell has died. So the only thing that the roundworm gene does is allow the response, essentially, the pulls the trigger, as it were, on a defense response that the plant already has, which is killing off a few cells so that the whole tree will live.
If we do this kind of genetic modification, but just use it to replace the Cavendish and say, okay, we're doing the new Cavendish strain and planting it everywhere we used to do Cavendish, are we just setting ourselves up for the next fungus in 2 decades?
Absolutely. So that's why the better approaches involve, if they use GMOs, involve putting the modification into a wide variety of different plants. And so one example of this is we've been talking about Cavendish, a dessert banana, but the vast majority of the world's bananas are grown for local consumption and they're cooking bananas or plantains. And those are crucial, especially in East Africa and Indonesia. They are the foundation, the potato, if you will, or the bread of people's diets. And there, the GMOs that confer resistance to various diseases have been put into a wide variety of different local types of cooking bananas in order to try to get past the problem you identify of monoculture.
So the difference there might be if we Americans lost our bananas, bummer for us. If somebody loses their staple crop like the plantain you're talking about, that's a matter of life or death.
That's right. Another banana disease that's broken out in the last 20 years in East Africa has led to measurable major socioeconomic problems. Usually what happens is the family farm fails and the dad goes into town to try to get a job in the city. Sometimes he succeeds, sometimes not. Mom can't pay the kids' school fees anymore. Kids drop out of school. There's a whole ripple effect that's really very destructive, and also nutritional losses. At the very worst, you end up with hunger.
Talking to Caitlin Allen, professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, looking at crops around the world that are faced with threats of disease. Banana, the poster child of that right now, but it's not alone. Coffee, cocoa, and oranges, citrus fruits. Caitlin, I know you have your eye on, even here in the United States. What are we seeing with our citrus?
The citrus disease that people are really worried about right now is called citrus greening, and it arrived in Florida in about 2005, where it spread really rapidly. It's caused, and most people don't recognize this, Rob, a 70% decrease in the yield, the output of oranges from Florida. And this disease is incurable at this point, although there is a GMO that has not, of course, been approved yet that does resist it. And it is now spread into California, where so most of the oranges from Florida are made into juice, but most of our eating oranges come from the West, California, Arizona, and so forth. So at the moment, we don't have a solution for this, and we don't have wild varieties of citrus that have good resistance. This has really been a catastrophe.
We have an email from Monica who says she makes her living as a baker. Ingredients like bananas, coffee, and chocolate are really important to her work and her bottom line. Monica wants to know how she should be thinking about recipe development in the future and how she can contribute to more diverse and sustainable practices.
Oh, Monica, what a great question. I do think that flexibility, especially using local ingredients, so whether that's persimmons or cranberries or, you know, whatever Wisconsin has to offer, or just trying out a few other options. It's challenging and it requires flexibility, but we want to push this at every level. We want the growers to be more flexible and we want consumers to be more flexible too.
Thanks so much for that question, Monica. Are there pathogens, diseases out there that affect plants that could affect multiple kinds of crops? And we were talking about a banana-specific one, a coffee-specific one. Are there ones that are threats to multiple kinds of crops?
There are. There are a number of pathogens that have wide host ranges. But most of them, like human diseases, are fairly specific to a small group of related organisms. But every once in a while, you come to one that can go to multiple different crops, and those cause even bigger problems. I study one called bacterial wilt that has hundreds of different hosts. Fortunately, it's not a problem in Wisconsin, but it is a big problem in the tropics, partly because of its broad host range.
Not a problem in Wisconsin. Was there an yet in parentheses there?
It would have to get a lot warmer in Wisconsin. Okay. So this is a tropical pathogen.
Gotcha.
It is a problem in Florida.
Do we need to rethink the way we do agriculture here at a fundamental level, make some basic changes to make us less prone to the disruption that these pathogens can cause, not just to our food, but as you were saying earlier, to our societies?
Oh, boy, that is one big question. Here's the tension. Yes, we know that large-scale industrial monoculture is not safe, that it leads us to dependence on single organisms and it makes us really vulnerable to specific diseases and insects. On the other hand, it's profitable. It feeds the world. There are people who make an argument that you can do small-scale organic or perennial agriculture and feed the world, but the numbers don't support that. So we have to find a middle ground. And some of this is going to involve genetic engineering technology. We need to use all the tools that we have.
And you were just in our last few moments, you were talking about wanting more diversity, say more kinds of bananas at our stores. Can we do that at a scale? And so I guess it's profitable enough for people to want to do it in a way that's going to make a difference.
I think so. If I ran the whole zoo, I would move subsidies from large-scale crops like the big five in the U.S., wheat, corn, soybeans, and so forth, and put instead subsidies on fruits and vegetables that would make it more profitable for growers to produce different kinds and, you know, in some ways make things better for the consumer, too. People need to eat more fruits and vegetables.
We'll leave it there. Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Caitlin Allen. She's the Ethel and O.N. Allen Professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at the UW-Madison. She joins us today to talk about a disease that's ruining banana crops in much of the world, now arriving in South America, and how similar diseases could make food items disappear or be threatened in the future. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out calls for more family leave for moms and dads and the impact it could have on parents and the overall economy. We'll look ahead at the presidential race. White working class voters are often seen as President Trump's base. Our guest says things are more complicated than that here in Wisconsin. And who wants robocalls? Probably not you. We'll find out about the latest efforts to put new guidelines in the automatic phone call industry. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.